The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 318 premium for March 3rd, 2011, which is 3-3-1-1. Go! The show. I am Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire.
And I am John Efron here in Fairfield, Connecticut.
And you are our faithful, supportive premium listeners, and we very much appreciate that. So thanks for subscribing, thanks for supporting us, and thanks for sending in all your questions and your comments and all that good stuff, because without it, we wouldn't be doing this in the way that we're doing it. So thank you very much. It's true.
We'd be doing something, but
I'm sure we would. Right. Yeah. That's right. We love this.
We'd be talking to ourselves.
That's right. And that's okay. You know, we kind of enjoyed that. That's where this started, as you all likely know. But yeah. So do we need to talk about the iPad 2 at all, John? Are you gonna order one? So the iPad 2 came out yesterday.
Nope.
For those of you that don't know. It was announced yesterday. It has not come out yet, but kind of in a rundown, it's same size, right? Basically, slightly thinner case, somewhat lighter, maybe 10% lighter, and same screen, same pixel resolution, new dual core processor, double the RAM, which Apple never really talks about, but that's okay. Two cameras, slightly redesigned speaker, Verizon 3G and AT&T 3G version, as well as a Wi-Fi version, and now HDMI out via an accessory, which reportedly will also work with the iPhone 4. And pricing remains the same. So what do you think, John?
I have, you know, of course, I read the, you know, coverage on Mac Observer.
Of course.
All the other sites, and my Twitter stream was polluted.
Yes.
And then
there's a good chart on Mac Observer that compares the iPad 1 and iPad 2 and Motorola. Most people have probably read it already, because based on traffic, it seems like everybody in the world did, which was a nice little thing. But
what's the fancy stand that they have now?
The case you're talking about?
Yeah. With the little magnets and stuff.
Yeah, it's got magnets in it. I don't like magnets. Magnets scare me. But yeah, it's a magnetic cover, I guess.
Right? Smart covers.
Smart case. Smart case is what they're calling
it. Smart covers.
Is that right? Smart cover. You're right.
Yes. Well, I'm looking at apple.com, and of course it's plastered on the front page. There,
that's right.
But that looks pretty darn clever. So it's not only, you know, with some little magnets, as you pointed out, which probably is not a big deal for
everybody,
you know, a device. Yeah, well.
I can feel them, John. I can feel magnets. They freak me out.
All right. And but it also acts as kind of a fancy little stand. So it's such a simple, elegant piece of engineering.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
I worry it's not going to be enough. You know, but it's totally Apple. This is one of those times where I really believe they don't see the forest from the trees. There are a lot of times when they push their own agenda for many reasons. But it's all, you know, they're aware of what they're doing. In terms of cases, I just don't think they get it. You know, the iPhone certainly can be used without a case, right? If you don't mind it getting scratched up and that sort of thing. And maybe that bothers you, maybe it doesn't. But the iPad, certainly the iPad 1, I haven't had a chance to use the iPad 2 at all yet, of course. But certainly with the iPad 1, there was no way I could use that functionally without a case. And not because the case protects it, but because I wanted to be able to, you know, rest it at different angles and have it held up. And yes, I realize Apple's case, this smart cover thing, does that. It allows you to stand it up on its end in a landscape mode, and also then flip over and be used as kind of a, you know, coffee table keyboard type thing, also in portrait mode. But I don't know if it's going to be substantial enough to really work as a case. I mean, it clearly is built from the standpoint of, why would you want to obscure my beautiful device? right? And that's the thing that Apple never, that's kind of the mentality that any case that Apple's put out, right? The stupid bumper for the, what the heck was that? I mean, for the iPhone, that's stupid. That's not a case. It's a piece of plastic that goes around the edge. I don't want that. If I want to protect it, I want to protect the glass, dum-dum. You know, but
yeah,
I don't know. I worry about these smart covered silliness, but we'll see.
All right. I'm, you know, again, Dave, I got to slow down. I mean, I just got an iPhone.
I know.
And actually personally, what I use for that is something that actually we got in a prior swag bag in it. And it actually, I'm pretty happy with it from Griffin. It's a Elan holster.
Oh, you're one of those people. I only thought pilots and with a nod to Pilot Pete and general contractors used holsters for their cell phones.
Well, the thing that I like about it is that it doesn't require me to wrap the iPhone in something.
Right.
Which, right. You know, I mean, just like the iPad, it's a beautiful looking, precision crafted piece of hardware. And when I'm not using it now, you know, I don't use it. I mean, it has a belt clip, which I'm not quite ready to, you know, go into Batman mode and have it.
Okay. Because that's what always reminds me of the former comic.
No, but I just like it because it fully envelops the product. But when you need to use it, then I just pull it out of this holster and, you know, I carry it in my pocket using this case. But it provides protection because I'm definitely afraid that if and when I drop it, you know, it's going to go get smashed.
Don't you? Here's the thing. Yeah. Okay. So you have to take it out of this holster thing to use it. But my question is, you're not going to drop it while it's in your pocket. You're going to drop it while you have it in your hands, and potentially even drop it while you're fumbling with it with one hand while you've got the case in the other. Perhaps. And you're extracting it. Right. So I don't know. I'm not on board with that.
Well, I don't like the cases that envelop it because then you can't use something like the Glyph, which I think is very nice, but the Glyph is precision crafted. And if the iPhone is enveloped in anything,
it doesn't work.
Then that it doesn't work.
That's right. So maybe you're just maybe you need like a invisible shield or something akin to that for your phone to protect it, and then you're good to go.
Perhaps, but it looks like a nice evolutionary. You know, I think they got cameras now.
The cameras are cool.
Have a camera
and the faster processor, I think, will make a big difference.
Yeah. And as far as you know, who presented what? I think Steve basically presented because I've noticed this the stock. You know, there were all these, you know, rumors about, you know, Steve's health and stuff like that. And I think he was just saying, look, I'm still running things. Okay.
Right.
I haven't yet watched the keynote. And this is something I didn't know. So I actually added it to my iTunes feed, but I didn't know that they have a channel for the Apple events.
The podcast channel. That's right.
Yes.
Yes.
I didn't know that. So I added that to my iTunes and it showed up. It showed up
last night, yesterday afternoon, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, so I haven't yet watched it, but I'm sure, you know, as all Apple events, it was well executed and everybody was happy. So
I'm sure.
And the stock, I think, showed that, you know, I think there was a pretty positive reaction to it. So,
yep,
all right. Sure. But we're the Mac geek, Gab, not the iPad or the iPhone.
See, I it's interesting you say that. I was thinking about that in the shower last night. And this is not the first time we've talked about this. But, you know, I don't see the iPad. I mean, I see that as you know, as much of a Mac as it is an iPhone, right? I mean, I see it replacing Macs for a lot of people, and therefore kind of falling into that realm of, it's a computer, you know? Yeah.
Sure. And, well, as our listeners are going to find out, there is actually an iPhone, somewhat iPhone-specific question coming up, which now that I have one, I can answer in a somewhat informed manner.
There you go. All right, cool. All right. So, but first we'll go to Terry, and Terry asks, I've just added a 13-inch MacBook Air to carry to the office. So my MacBook Pro 15-inch can stay at home. It's a little heavy to carry back and forth to the office and on the road. My question is this: I've used my 2 terabyte time capsule for a little over a year with nothing but my MacBook Pro 15-inch. How do I add my Air as a backup client to the time capsule? If this were a voice message, this would be where you cut me. So go ahead, John.
Well, you know, now I don't do this, Dave. So we'll bounce it back and forth. I personally do not do this.
Really?
And I was wondering about this.
Okay.
No, I have my two main machines. I have my MacBook Pro, early 2008, which is going to last me forever.
Of course it will.
And my Mac Mini. But my strategy, Dave, is I have my time capsule. I use it as a time machine only for the MacBook. Well, what do I use for the Mini, you ask? Well, what I use for the Mini is a case I got from OWC, which I put my old 3.5-inch hard drive from the G5. I put it in this case. It's connected via, it's an EasyQuest case, I think. It's a really nice case, and it's connected via FireWire 800. And then I partition the drive into two partitions, which normally, you know, I don't like doing. But in this case, it just didn't make sense to have a terabyte to back up the Mini. So I split it into 500 gigs for Time Machine and 500 gigs for general data storage.
Oh, okay.
So I am a one machine to one time machine disk type of guy here. But then I wondered, well, can you do this? And as far as I can tell, Dave, and you can verify this, so I went into Time Machine on one of my machines and I, you know, clicked on Time Machine and you can say select disk.
Yep.
And sure enough, all the disks on my network, including the time capsule. So right now I'm on the Mini and I click on the disk choices and it shows my two partitions that are on the FireWire 800 drive, and it shows Time Capsule.
Right.
So I'm going to guess that if I wanted to, I could certainly use the Time Capsule.
You absolutely can. I have...
Excellent.
Let me see. So I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 machines that back up to our Time Capsule. But, you know, here's the thing. It's fine when you start them all. I think we started 5 of them, you know, all at sort of at the beginning when we got the time capsule. And that was fine because there was a terabyte of space out on this time capsule and everything worked all right. Now, of course, adding a new machine to it requires managing some space. Thankfully, for me, I had saved a couple of large backup archives also off to the time machine because, as we've mentioned in a previous show, and it's worth re-mentioning, the time capsule rather can act as simply network storage. You don't have to use it as a time machine destination, and it doesn't have to solely be a time machine destination. However, as with any time machine destination, time machine will fill up all available space eventually. Now, eventually can be very soon if you wind up changing data or adding data a lot to your Macs, or it could take a while. And of course, it depends on how much space you have available, but it will eventually fill it all up. And by the time I wanted to add the 6th machine to our time capsule, it was basically running full, which means when and this isn't unique to the time capsule. It happens on any time machine destination volume. But when you hit when the drive gets full or almost full, time machine is smart enough to not let it go all the way to the end. It starts deleting old versions of the backup. But Time Machine's not smart enough to look at all the backups on a volume. It only looks at the one for the machine that it's backing up at that moment in time. So there's no sort of overseer management done by the time capsule or time machine. But thankfully, when I wanted to add the 6th one, I deleted a very large archive that I had kind of tossed out there, and that made room. And I actually wound up doing the same thing with when I added the 7th machine. And they, you know, some of these machines don't have very much storage. The 3 of them are using probably, you know, 50 gigs or less. And one of them significantly less than that. But still, you know, the drive is constantly running at near capacity, you know, maybe 10 gigs, 5 gigs left on the,
Let me get your feedback on this.
Just to answer Terry's question, yes, you can do it. But if your 15-inch MacBook Pro's backups have filled up your time capsule to the point where it is full, then no, you cannot do it because you have to have enough room left on your time capsule to start the first backup, which can be a big one, as we discussed recently. So what you may need to do is either one of two things. Either wipe out your 15-inch MacBook Pro's backups and start from scratch with that, kind of resetting back to zero and losing all the data that you've, losing the backups of the data that you saved there. Or go into Time Machine. And you may not know this, but you can go into Time Machine in the Finder by going into the Finder and clicking on Time Machine in the menu bar is probably the best way to get there and say enter Time Machine. And then you can navigate around and find large files, and you can right click on those files and say remove from Time Machine backups. And that will remove all copies of that. So if you have, let's say, a VMware or Parallels, you know, Windows instance that you've saved out there, it, that could be huge. It could be, you know, 10 gigs, maybe even 20 gigs. And you could remove that from your backups. It won't delete it from your drive. It'll just delete it from the backups. And that might make enough room, depending on where you are again, to get that second machine out there. So you can either go through and delete that. But once you've got the second machine out there, then the things will start to manage themselves a little bit because the first backup is done. But that might be the only issue. But if you've got enough room, then adding it is inconsequential. You won't even know that you're adding it to a drive that has anything else on it. So that's that part of it. But go ahead, John. We should wrap this up and move on, but go ahead.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And yeah, to wrap it up. So each backup is keyed. And let me answer this. Each backup. So what I suggested is you may want to just make sure that the name of the machine is different, which of course you set in system preferences. I think sharing.
Right.
Is the name of the machine. Now, as far as I can see, and while I know there's some action with UUIDs and all that, but my suggestion was just make sure the machine has a different name because it does key the folders, at least on the machine name. Now, maybe something else. But that was the one caution I had. The other advice I had is you may want to try this, although it's technically unsupported. You can hang another hard drive off of your time capsule, or as we found, Dave, Airport Extreme, and it will show up as an available disk for Time Machine, at least last I checked. I mean, that's actually how, you know, I told you when I set up my mom's system, that's how she set up. It's an old drive that I had put in a USB enclosure, and that's the drive that it backs up to with Time Machine. And it seems to work fine, though I understand, again, Apple says we don't officially support
and that's hanging off of a time capsule?
No, I'm sorry. It's hanging off an Airport Extreme.
Okay, but I think the same thing will work with the time capsule, to be honest.
Oh, it absolutely does.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, I verified that. If I plugged the USB drive into the time capsule, it would then show up as a drive that could be used for Time Machine. So, okay. So I guess to the space issue, you could kind of do like what I'm doing now.
That is supported by Apple then, right? If it's hanging off of a time machine or a time capsule, then
I think
it
would be supported for AirDisk. I'm not sure. And actually, Adam actually had a question about this. And I think his comment was, again, Apple, I don't think officially supports a AirDisk as a Time Machine destination, but AirDisk to work.
AirDisk connected to an Airport Extreme, but an AirDisk connected to a time capsule, I believe, is supported. Now that I think back about it. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And again, in both cases, they work. So I think in his case, that may be another option to prevent this problem that he's going to eventually run into, where it's going to get full and then it's going to start purging. And I can tell you, because I actually wipe mine clean when it starts purging.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a real long time to purge in order to find enough space.
Yes and no.
It can. Well, in my case, all of a sudden it said, well, I need 200 gigs and it's not available. And so it started expiring teeny little backups day by day.
Right.
It wasn't smart enough to say, well, I know that a month's worth of your stuff equals the amount that I need, so I'm going to expire that. No, it went day by day.
Right.
Or whatever, week by week, you know, whatever resolution it had.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it does one at a time. That's right. And if that's enough, then it's almost inconsequential. You don't even notice it happening. But yeah, otherwise. All right. Karsten writes, how do I convert an MP3 audiobook to an M4B iTunes supported audiobook? I own the Harry Potter CDs and have ripped them all to one single MP3 file. On a PC, I encode them to the audiobook format using freeipodsoftware.com. The software encodes the file and imports to iTunes, but the problem is when synced to my iPhone, it shows up as an audiobook but says 777 minutes and will not play. So my question is, how do I convert the MP3 files to a working audiobook format? I'm sure there's many ways to do this. The way I have done it in the past is I use iTunes to take the MP3 and convert it to AAC. The reason for this is audiobooks in iTunes are M4B, and M4B means AAC book, essentially. So you convert it first from MP3 to AAC. Now you do this by first going into iTunes preferences and setting your encode format on the general tab, I believe is where it is now, to AAC. Once you've done that, then you can simply highlight an MP3 in iTunes and go to the advanced menu, I think, and choose convert to AAC. Once that's done, it gets a little tricky. You got to right click on the M4 on the AAC file that's been created and choose reveal in Finder. Once you're in the Finder, you'll see that it's an M4A file. Change the file type to M4B or make a copy and change the copy's name to M4B and then re-import that back into iTunes. I know it's sort of crazy, but when you drag it back in, iTunes will say, oh, it's an M4B file, must be an audiobook, and it processes it up and packages it all the right way. And that should work with your iPhone. That's my story anyway.
I trust you.
All right, good. Hopefully it works for Karsten. And the trust is well deserved. Okay. Tracy writes and has multiple problems here. We'll talk about at least the first one and probably the second. Well, maybe not. Probably just the first one. Tracy says, my friend in Wisconsin needs a computer really bad, so I'm sending her my old iBook G4. I want to do an erase and install, but I can't find the disks. So I went to the Genius Bar and they said, no, it's too old. We can't do it. So I decided to add a fresh new user with administrative privileges and then sequentially remove the two prior user accounts on the machine, hoping that would free up the disk space for my friend. This seemed to work. However, now that I'm finished, I noticed the name of the hard disk is //. Is that bad? And did I do something idiotic and short-sighted? Will it have any meaningful ramifications for my pal who is receiving the machine? She basically just wants it for mail. So here's the thing. There have been reports of hard drive names causing problems on Macs. In fact, there was John Donahue, one of our sales reps at Backbeat Media, before he was even a sales rep here, he had called me and he said, Dave, I can't get Snow Leopard to install right on my Mac. And he got Snow Leopard to install, but he couldn't play Flash videos. That's what it was. It would crash anytime he went to a website, and we tried all kinds of different things. And as it turns out, he brought it into the Genius Bar and they said, oh, it's because you have too many numbers in your hard drive name. And he didn't know he had renamed his hard drive. Just like, yeah. And we talked about this on the show. It was one of those really weird things. And so they said, just change your hard drive to something, you know, with either less numbers or no numbers, and it'll be fine. And they changed it, and magically everything worked. Blew me away that this actually solved the problem. But thankfully, the genius that he brought it to knew. So there can be weird problems with hard drive names. Now, in your case in particular, Tracy, with your hard drive being named //, in Unix, one single slash typically refers to the root volume. Now, when you're in Unix, your hard drive it's just slash, regardless of the name. But if you go into the volumes directory, then it's going to be listed as // inside the volumes directory. And while it probably won't cause any trouble, it just doesn't sound like a good idea. The good news is you can rename your hard drive in Mac OS X like really, really easily. The easiest way is to, well, you can do it in the Finder and just do it, highlight the hard drive and do a file get info in the Finder. And you can change the name right there. Just go ahead and change it in the name and extension section. And then that's it. You're done. So what happened? You can also do it from the desktop, and that's probably how it got changed to //. You probably just clicked it accidentally and changed it. So go back into the Finder, change it to something that's more descriptive. Even Macintosh hard drive or Macintosh HD, which is the default, is fine. Spaces are allowed. You know, make it whatever you like, but // just from my years of Unix experience, it feels wrong, even though I know it'll probably be okay. Does that sound good, John?
I think if you had to choose a worse character, that is probably the worst character to choose, again, well, because it's a delimiter. Yeah, well, dot, yes, which means current directory, I guess, or
right.
Two dots.
Dot,
means
dot, dot would be even worse. Yeah, that's right.
But slash, yeah, is a delimiter, and I would think that some software may get confused. Although I think technically it's just as a number is, which I'm surprised, you know, that point you brought up to me about numbers being in the name of the drive or directory. I mean, technically I think it's a valid character, but to be safe, I would say, yeah, rename it to something that is alpha alpha. I'm just going to say alpha here.
Yeah. Well, you can definitely have numbers in there.
I like numbers. Like I've done that. Yeah. I've called drives, you know, 1 terabyte monster or something like that. So I'd say as long as you stick to alphanumerics and spaces, I think you'll be okay.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think most operations also use the, well, this is getting kind of geeky, but hey, no, but they, I mean, they can tell the difference between drives based on the UUID, I believe it is, you know, buried deep within the drive there. But still, some applications may look at the name of the drive, and if they're not expecting a slash or they don't parse the name of the drive correctly, then bad things will happen.
Right. So. Right. That's right.
Like flash.
Like, exactly.
Among the other issues it seems to have.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. Antonio, and I think we've got a couple from Antonio, but we'll do them one at a time here. We've got a lot from Antonio. Antonio writes, I've been running iStat menus for about 1 month, and I would like to know your recommendations. Does running iStat menus slow down your computer significantly? I'm using the same MacBook Pro pre-unibody 2008 that you guys have with 4 gigs of RAM. What do you guys do? And do you have it running all the time in the background? Go ahead, John, take this one and we'll paste through the rest of these.
So my answer is yes. But then you may ask, well, how do I know how much, you know, how busy is iStat? You know, should I be running it? Is it going to, you know, is it taking a lot of processor? And the answer is no. And the reason, and the way you can find this out, Dave, is you run Activity Monitor.
iStat menus.
Oh, well, duh. Well, yes, but I don't believe iStat menus is going to show.
It does. It shows itself as long as nothing else. If you have the top 5 processes listed.
Right. Okay. It may show it. But basically what I did is I ran Activity Monitor and I see 2 processes. And I'm going to guess that the one we're really concerned about, because it's the only one I see with a CPU percentage figure in Activity Monitor, is something called iStat Local Daemon. Right. And I think both you and I, Dave, had the same experience because we have similar machines, but it, when it's running and doing its work and showing you what's happening on your system, it's running at no more than maybe 1.5% CPU, which to me is a fair price to pay for all of the stuff that it does.
That's right.
So I would say, run it all the time. It's I don't see any downside if you have a fairly recent Mac. I think you indicated, Dave, sometimes maybe in the past, iStat was a bit busy.
Well, that's why I used menu meters, you know, long ago, was because iStat took up about 3-6% of my CPU at the time, and menu meters was taking up about 0.5%. I don't think anything has changed other than I'm running a faster Mac now. iStat, you know, it's 1.5%, doesn't cost me as much, and I frankly don't notice it. It's not, you know, it's not anything significant. So and I think you'll probably find the same thing, Antonio. All right. Number 2, I installed around Christmas an OWC Mercury Extreme 250 gig SSD drive. It has considerably increased the speed performance on this computer. However, I occasionally have experienced computer freezes that I need to restart my computer. I installed Snow Leopard twice from the DVD in order to be able to start the computer again. I don't have any hardware attached to it, and I'm not watching any DVDs. I've sent along a crash report, and it looks like Safari has crashed. These crashes seem to be more often after the computer goes to sleep on its own. And now we get kind of into a second question here, which we'll answer separately. Any problems with having an SSD going into sleep mode? And I did a smart check of the new hard drive. It's okay. I even ran Disk Warrior on it and it shows okay. What is the best practice for running SSDs? Okay. So separating the second part of that question out here, I'm talking about these crashes, looking a little deeper, these crash logs, they can contain a lot of gobbledygook. And that's my technical term for the gobbledygook that appears. But if you read the beginning of them, maybe the first 10, 15 lines, you can get an idea of what's going on. And as Antonio did, he looked at his crash log and he noticed that the process, the first thing listed was Safari. So, okay, that's, you know, one thing. Looking a little deeper, this one shows that there is a plugin path and a plugin identifier that identifies a plugin called LogMeIn as being the culprit or related to this crash. So perhaps there was some, you know, activity going on. Maybe this plugin was being used to remote control a computer because that's what LogMeIn does. And maybe there was a conflict with it that caused this crash. Of course, these crashes that are happening waking from sleep, that's a little bit different. And no, there's no problems with SSDs and waking from sleep that I know of, and certainly not with the OWC drives. So I don't think your crashes are SSD related. Instead of looking at the crash log, take a look at the console log and see if anything appears there. If the crashes are sort of random but still happening, it might be that you have some bad RAM. And that can be tested with the Apple hardware test. There are better ways to test it. The thing that comes with Applejack, which we'll put a link to, is a command line memory tester, but it's way more comprehensive than the one on Apple's DVD. But that's kind of where I would look. It's very hard to say without more information, but random crashes. Yeah. Console log is kind of the first place I would look if you can get there. So any thoughts on the crashes before we move on to the final question for this round?
I'm with you. Okay. It was great that I suggested that he may want to send that in to the LogMeIn folks because right. It looks like, well, it may not have been the cause. Something else may have caused it to crash, but at least it's a place to start. So at the very least, you know, because usually these reports don't go to the developer. They go to Apple for them to figure out what's wrong with Mac OS X.
Right.
But he may want to send this off to LogMeIn because I assume that he has that installed and knows he does. well, that could be the other thing is you may have leftovers and they're causing an issue. But I'm going to assume that he's actively running it. So you may want to send it off to him just as a goodwill gesture and say, hey, guys. And also I noticed that he's running in 64-bit. And I don't know if that's an issue, or at least I saw 64 after everything, which, of course, you can run many machines in. I actually, on both my machines, run them in 64-bit mode, both my MacBook Pro and the Mini, which I don't think is the default, but I just like doing it because that's the type of guy I am.
Makes you feel better. Actually, we talked about that during the pre-show or the post-show from the show on Monday. And since then, I've been running my MacBook Pro in 64-bit mode. I couldn't get the iMac at the house to boot into 64-bit mode, so it might not be one of the supported ones. I haven't messed with it a whole lot, but I did it. And there's an Apple Knowledge Base article. I did it using a command line incantation. It's just one little phrase that you type in.
There's a utility that does it for you. Yes, you could do the hand wave.
Yeah.
But there's a utility that basically does the mucking about that you're doing manually. So
yeah, it's just, it edits the boot.plist file or whatever it is.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Right. But to me, there's no downside to running in 64-bit kernel mode unless you have hardware or software that doesn't have 64-bit support, which here and there, it doesn't exist.
Right.
I won't go into more detail because I'm working out with the people that make the software that doesn't work in 64-bit to see if they're going to update it.
Well, there you go. Yeah, no, there's stuff. Yeah, for sure. And I believe Lion, if I understand the reports correctly, only runs 64-bit mode, correct? Or am I mistaken on that?
Based on the reports that I've read, if you want to install the developer preview, I believe one of the requirements is a Mac that supports 64-bit.
Okay.
Which I believe the older Macs, like the Core Duo, is only 32-bit. So I think if you have a Core Duo machine,
got it.
You're out of luck. If you have a Core 2 Duo, then you should be okay.
Well, I thought there were some Core 2 Duo machines.
Maybe there are some
support 64-bit apps but won't boot 64-bit. There's something about that, man.
Well, I think the thing is, Dave, is that as far as I know, the Core 2 Duo will. The thing is, some machines,
the EFI will not support it
unless you give them a nudge. I think you got to give some machines like ours a nudge. Like normally our machines, they've booted into the 32-bit kernel.
Yeah, I think there's more to it than that.
And even the Mini I have.
I think there's more to it than that.
There could be. We'll read up on it.
I think there's some iMacs that just won't boot 64, even though they'll run 64-bit code in the apps. I got to research more. I'm fearing I might have one or more of those iMacs here. So,
okay.
All right, lastly.
So the other question.
Yeah, with his SSD, what's the... He asked, what's the best thing to do with it? My advice, not very much at all. You need to remember most hard drive utilities are built for mechanical drives that, you know, that need to have blocks checked and potentially things defragmented or optimized. all of those activities are terrible for an SSD. Nothing could be worse for them. However, they still have file systems or table of contents, right? And we've talked about this a couple of times, but when you save a file to your hard drive, it saves it out wherever it saves it on the drive, and then it saves a little pointer in the table of contents that says, hey, this file exists and it's out there at this location. Well, that table of contents can get corrupted, and it can get corrupted on an SSD just like on any other hard drive. So running Disk Utilities Repair Disk, it's not really repairing the disk. It's repairing the table of contents for the disk, or even Disk Warrior, which rebuilds the table of contents for the disk. That's okay on an SSD. You don't want to obsess about it, but it is good, especially Disk Utility, to run at least verify disk, you know, once every couple of months to make sure it's not out of whack. And if it is, repair it or use something like Disk Warrior to rebuild it.
Yeah, that was my suggestion. Actually, I verified this with the other day. I was running Drive Genius, and I tried to defrag an SSD, and it said, you know, if you really want to, I'll let you, but you really don't need to. It's kind of dumb. So
how did it know you had an SSD?
Because if you go into System Profiler, Dave, and you look at a drive, there is now a field, which I don't know when they introduced this, that indicates the type of drive. And it can either be rotational or solid state.
Right. But most SSD drives do not report that correctly when they're installed aftermarket.
Well, all I know is on my machine, Dave, on my MacBook Pro, when I was testing out the Samsung SSD, Profiler said solid state.
It did. Okay. Very interesting. My Runcore drive reports rotational.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm suspecting maybe...
It's a firmware thing in the drive.
Yeah. So they have something in the drive that he didn't... So I think by default, it'll assume rotational.
Right. Yeah, if the bit's not set. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Now, as far as practice... I just want to point out something that I noticed about the OWC that I think is a unique feature of it. So the only thing I mentioned was the only thing you may notice is that over time, the drive may slow down, because with many SSDs, the way the technology works right now is that writing to a fresh memory cell that has never been written to before is very fast. But the problem is the way the OS and the drive manage writing to a cell that has been marked as available but still has data in it slows the drives down in general. Now, OWC, I offered this advice to Antonio, and then I looked at OWC, and OWC actually says, well, no, we don't suffer from this problem. We're doing something, and the gist of it is that if memory cells are clean, Dave, then when an SSD tries to write to it, it doesn't have to do this read, erase, write cycle, which is what slows down some SSDs over time, because they're not really in sync with the operating system. Now, you can address it in two ways. One, and it seems OWC and others have figured this out, is the firmware in the background kind of cleans things up, so the next time the drive comes to it, it says, oh, fresh memory, great, I'm going to write and not do this hokey pokey.
Right.
The other thing is that there's this thing called a trim command, which is not supported in the current version of OS X, but reports that I've read say that Lion will support that. So based on what I've seen, he doesn't have to do anything special with this drive in order to keep it running at top speed.
Good. All right, cool. Moving on to Brian. He says, my coworker has an issue of the thumbnails not matching the pictures on his iPhone or vice versa. The background is everything was fine until he tried to upgrade to iOS 4.2 recently. Unfortunately, he has a Windows machine. During the upgrade, issues arose. He managed through the problems and after several attempts got 4.3 on his 3GS. I'm assuming he means 4.2, right? Isn't that what we're on now? I'm pretty sure we're on 4.2.
As far as I recall, yes.
Yeah, I think that's what he meant. When his phone recovered, he had his contacts and text chats, but lost all his pictures, apps, and music. He went on with life and revisited iTunes and synced his phone. Problem, now when he opens up the pictures app and the camera roll, all looks normal with a screen of thumbnails. However, choosing a thumbnail doesn't necessarily produce a full screen of the picture chosen. The same thumbnail will yield the same photo every time, but not every thumbnail produces a picture that was expected. He has tried restoring his phone to factory defaults and resyncing, but the results are the same. What happened and how does he fix this? It appears random which thumbnails will produce the wrong picture. Some are old archive photos, some are new pictures just taken. Have you ever seen such a thing? One more thing. Opening a picture show, say picture 180 of 340 per usual. The funny thing is he only has 120 pictures on his phone now. All right, John, you are our iPhoto resident iPhoto guy. So go.
Oh, not anymore. iPhoto? No, I know. No. I know. No, you mean iPhone.
Well, okay.
Oh, wait, did he say iPhoto? I don't think he mentioned iPhoto here specifically. You said iPhoto.
I did say iPhoto. I assume he's syncing pictures from iPhoto to his iPhone.
Oh, no. Well, number one, well, let me help clear things up for you, my friend. So one, he's saying syncing. Okay.
Right.
If I read this right.
Right.
And actually, this brings up an interesting question, which I think we've addressed in other. Mm-hmm. But anyways, you have two things. I don't think we covered it in the last podcast, though. It was another question. So again, now that I have the iPhone, I can address these. There are two different things that you can do with your iPhone regarding photos when it interacts with your Mac. One is you can import.
You can treat it like a camera. That's right.
Right. And that's exactly what happens. So if you take pictures with your iPhone and you plug it into your Mac, by default, I think what it's going to do, and you can change this, but it's going to launch a photo app, whether it be iPhoto, Aperture, or Image Capture, I think is the default.
Right.
Because it sees it as a camera.
Right.
So that's one mode here. And that's why I just wanted to clarify here. That's not what we're talking about here.
Right.
The other thing that you can do with your iPhone is you can synchronize photos from your Mac or PC to the phone itself. And that's where I think the problem is here.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Okay.
Now here's the thing. And I actually did this just for kicks. So it turns out, like a lot of other things we talk about, the way that iTunes work. And one thing is going to be not a fish shake, but a finger wag at Apple is, why are you doing photo syncing in iTunes? Huh? What the? It just doesn't make sense to me. But
well,
that's,
they do contact syncing, calendar syncing, exactly, and mail syncing. There, right? I mean, it is the software that manages the syncing aspect of your iPhone or iDevice.
Right. Yeah. So to me, it's weird that it's in iTunes, but it's in iTunes. And so iTunes, one of the options is when you plug in your iDevice, is a tab is going to appear when you click on the device that says Photos, and if you click on that, you're going to see a checkbox saying Sync Photos With. Now, depending on what, if you're on the Mac side, it's going to say iPhoto and Aperture because it knows about those apps. If you're on the Windows side, I think it just is going to give you options of your pictures folder, similar to the Mac, or another folder.
Right.
But in both cases, what happens, and this is why I think it was just a general suggestion. So I tried it on the Windows side at first, and then I looked on the Mac side, and the same thing happened. The first time you do this, what happens is that iTunes builds a folder within the folder that you indicate, at least if you point to a folder full of pictures.
Okay.
It builds a little folder called, oddly enough, iPod Photo Cache. Even if you're running an iPhone, it's still called iPod Photo Cache. And what's in that folder? Well, I looked and there's a big old file called Photo Database. And then what happens is there is a whole bunch of oddly named folders. And within those, Dave, I noticed there were files that were blah, 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 .ithmb. What could that be?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You know, I think that's a thumbnail. So here's my suspicion is what happened at one point in time, whatever's in that folder, which as far as I can tell, it's a cache. It doesn't impact anything. And it wasn't there before I synced the photos on either side. I tried it both on the Mac and on the PC. So what I'm going to suggest is that whatever is in that iPod photo cache folder is, to be technical, all screwed up.
That's right. We call it FUBAR here.
It's FUBAR'd.
That's right.
So the only thing I can imagine is that the thumbnails and the photo database within that folder are just FUBAR'd. And your best course of action is to get rid of that folder and let iTunes start from scratch, and I think everything's going to be cool. As far as I know, this is a one-way operation in that it's not going to impact whatever's on the phone itself.
Right.
Unless I'm missing something. I mean, I just started looking at this.
No, but that sounds right.
The sync feature, from what I can see in iTunes, is strictly to take things that are on your computer and stuff them into the iPhone.
Right.
And as we pointed out earlier, the opposite direction is a distinct part of the phone itself, and that it's not. So I don't think deleting that folder is going to destroy anything important.
Yeah. You could move it out of the way as opposed to deleting it. Now, just to get a process down, I would say disconnect your iPhone from your computer, quit iTunes, then go and either delete or move this iPod photo cache folder, then start up iTunes, reconnect your phone and do the sync. It may take a lot longer. The reason for this is it's twofold. One, to create these thumbnails, it creates them in iTunes and then syncs them off to the device. Mm-hmm. But number two, you can, I believe, and it depends on the device, but you can have it sync lower resolution versions of your pictures if you want. And again, it depends on what device you're syncing to and where you're getting the pictures from. But that cache will also store those lower resolution versions so that the next time you sync, you don't have to wait for your computer to create these. It just syncs the ones that it's already created. However, when that cache gets corrupted, as John pointed out, you got to rebuild it. And so that might take some time, but I agree with you. I think that should solve the problem. Yeah. 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 Good stuff. When I said iPhoto, of course he's probably not using iPhoto cause he's on Windows. But we had an iPhoto or an Aperture question recently, and I know you've moved to Aperture recently, as have many people. In fact, I think the App Store pricing, I mean, simply the inclusion of Aperture in the App Store, but its pricing there, it's $79, has really opened up Aperture to a lot of people. And it was interesting. We got a comment from Scott here that really kind of it made me stop and think. So I'm gonna parse through the comment here, and he says, Scott says, I believe the reason that Aperture doesn't have a built-in auto import feature, and was talking about an answer to Rick's question how he wanted to auto import into Aperture, but he says, I believe the reason that Aperture doesn't have a built-in auto import feature is because the target audience would not use it, and it may even be harmful. And okay, maybe harmful is too strong a word. As a photographer who uses Aperture as my main repository of images, I would hate it if Aperture tried to auto import anything. I have a library for personal stuff, a library for stock images I may be able to sell, a library for contracted work, etc. I understand John is using it in a different way and may not have seen it this way. I have an extensive array of folders, project albums in each library, and there would be no way for Aperture to know where my images need to be stored. And if such a feature existed and got turned off by accident, or got turned on by accident, I would scream. So this is interesting because Aperture, certainly when it came out, really was targeted at and probably used only by or mostly by professional photographers, right? People that were doing this for a living with their, you know, with their work and doing things exactly, exactly as Scott describes. However, there's a new breed of Aperture users, right? And this has been created for two reasons. One is what I mentioned before, the pricing of Aperture and its availability in the App Store. But even more than that, or before that, was the fact that iPhoto kind of starts to bog down when you have a lot of pictures in there. And so Aperture has kind of become the de facto, I need iPhoto Pro. And there are many, many home users or prosumer users or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, the DSLR revolution, the fact that we all own these things now in our homes, which is crazy to own a digital SLR, or at least if you go back 5 years, it sounds crazy to own one. But now, you know, we all own them and the pictures are bigger. And you might want to do more with them and you can take them in raw format and all that stuff. So it's created, you know, it's almost there's probably two very distinct classes of Aperture users now. And it's why we've started talking about it more in this show, is not so much the pro side, but the prosumer side. But Scott illustrates very, very clearly illustrates sort of a divide there that, yeah, there's this one app that two very different classes of people are using. One is just, you know, iPhoto Pro. And my guess is that you're in the iPhoto Pro camp, right, John? That it's just you want more, but you don't need, you know, you're not selling pictures and that sort of thing. So
I am in the camp, and I'm going to be careful here. I'm in the camp of people who expect it, especially using an iFi card.
Yep.
Which the iFi card which is used by both amateurs and professionals, by default had a feature where you could take, which for people that don't know, the iFi is a Wi-Fi card that you put in your camera. And as soon as you take the picture, it tosses it either online with a photo sharing site, or it puts it in a folder on your Mac.
Right.
And the way it worked with iPhoto, because iPhoto supports an auto import, and their software supported this, they're like, well, what do you want to do with your photos, John, or whoever? Do you want to put them in a folder, or do you want them imported into iPhoto as soon as you start it up?
Right.
And I was like, well, yeah, because that was the workflow that they got me used to.
Right.
Once I got Aperture, I was like, where did this go? And right. Then I started combing through the iFi forms and the Aperture forms. And sure enough, either for people who are pro photographers or people coming from iPhoto, and actually this failed for me, but they actually on the Aperture site, they have a script called Aperture Hot Folder 1.5. And what does it do? It does exactly what this missing functionality does. Right. It's a little automator script that says, hey, if I see photos in this folder, I'm going to push them into Aperture immediately. And some people need this. Some people don't.
Right.
Now, you make a valid point. One audience is iPhoto people who all of a sudden said, or iFi people that said, what? What happened? I thought this was a professional package. Well, it doesn't do what Aperture doesn't do what iPhoto does. And the thing is, I think they're careful. And I totally understand the point that, yeah, in certain workflows, because Aperture is so powerful as far as projects and albums and stuff like that, is some people certainly don't want things to happen automatically because it could destroy a carefully thought out and structured workflow.
That's right. Yeah. Well, you know, iPhoto certainly supports multiple libraries, but you got to know the secret handshake to get it to do it, which of course is holding down the Option key when booting. Aperture right out of the gate, you know, you can have multiple libraries and all that. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what Apple does with this, because I think more and more people are going to wind up using Aperture, and it's $79. If you're totally happy with iPhoto, I don't recommend switching. But if there's anything about iPhoto that makes you feel like, you know, gosh, I wish I wasn't living inside this tiny cardboard box, I want to go outside a little bit, then Aperture's it. And it's relatively short money. It's $80. So
yeah. And what swayed me, Dave, was number one, and then we'll move on. But I just want to, what swayed me was the number of adjustments that you can make to a photograph.
Right.
Way increased than as I'm, you know, evolving as a photographer, though albeit an amateur, it was just, wow, I can do so much more with my photos. And number two, efficiency, it gives you much more flexibility in how to sort your photos versus iPhoto. So that's where I'm coming from. And the thing that I got to say, as we pointed out in the last podcast, is thank goodness that Automator or Aperture exposes what it can do to Automator, because that gave me the total flexibility to do exactly what I wanted. Because actually I found that this plugin that I stumbled across called Aperture Hot Folder didn't work. And I think because I think it was developed for an earlier version. So it didn't always grab my photos when I wanted it to, but.
So we unintentionally probably just sold another couple hundred copies of Aperture here, but that's
well,
okay.
Apple's going to,
it's good.
Write us a check, right?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, right.
Well, do they do an affiliate program for App Store? They really should. Don't you think, Dave?
Yeah, they do. Actually.
Oh, they do? Really?
Yeah. And we can build an affiliate link for that. Sure, we'll put an affiliate link in the show notes. That's fine. But you don't have to. You know, it's fine. You folks support us. It's fine. If you want to support us via the affiliate link, that's fine too.
Or support Apple, which as a stockholder, I fully support.
There you go. Right. Yeah. Exactly. But no. You know. And
thanks,
so
Scott.
My
guess is a great point.
My guess is we will be getting more and more Aperture questions, and thankfully we have a user in our midst here with you, John. So that's good.
Does Lisa?
Lisa does. I don't. I'm not even an iPhoto guy. I have like one tiny iPhoto library that I deal with my pictures from the iPhone. I prefer to experience things as opposed to documenting them, which is weird given the business that I'm in, right? You know, having started Mac Observer with Brian and stuff. But remember, I was never the content guy. I like the back end stuff and the servers and running the business and all that. But yeah, when it comes to things like that, I'd much rather experience it and then perhaps report on my experiences later as I remember them. But documenting something throughout, I miss out on you, everyone. If you're taking pictures or otherwise documenting as something is happening, your experience of what happened is different. I'm not going to say you're missing out. That's it's just different, right? You know, because you're busy logging it in some way, shape or form, as opposed to simply experiencing it. So that's just me. I don't say that in a judging way. I just say that's not either.
I mean, Dave, you can either rely on your faulty memories of your experience, or you can have, you know, some nice concrete proof.
I don't need proof. I was there. It's my memories.
Are you sure? How do you know?
I got a pretty darn good memory, and I like its faults. It works very well.
Well,
filters
I'm with you
out
because,
the crap.
Well, because your brain does a great job of kind of smoothing them over to make them.
You got it.
Where photography, you got the harsh reality of.
That's right.
What happened. And sometimes right. That's unpleasant.
And that's why I'm a terrible blogger, right? Because I like talking, right? But this is a different sort of experience. So it's
Well, I don't either. Blogging, I think you and I both, I'm not a blogger. If anything,
you
write
far more than me. You write reviews on TMO. You write the Mac Gadgets.
Well, I don't see that as blogging.
No, but it's writing. Yeah.
It's true. If anything, I share what I see in the world through either Twitter or through my, you know, photo galleries.
Yeah.
That's how I like to share information. Yeah. I don't like writing my experiences. Now for a product review. Yes, of course. You know, either a gadget or even, you know, the show notes here.
Yep.
But yeah, blogging my life. I can't see that. I don't see documenting my life in text, in pictures, perhaps.
Yeah. See, that's
okay,
your thing.
Now let's, oh gosh, that was philosophical. Wasn't
it? That's good. All right. Okay. Mark writes, I've been wondering for a number of years how I could take full advantage of what I refer to as a category of cruft organizers. What I mean is applications like Yojimbo, DevonThink, Evernote, and others of the Mac software available. Since Dave spoke again about Yojimbo in one of the recent episodes, I thought I'd finally sit down and hammer out this question regarding workflow using one of these tools. I have all three of the above mentioned applications and have yet to use them for more than a few weeks. The question I have is, what is the best way to use these? Should I dump everything into one folder with no organization whatsoever, add tagging to increase the searchability, or another yet undiscovered method? I crave the seemingly perfect solution that other users of Yojimbo, Evernote, or DevonThink seem to have, everything available at the press of a spotlight search. Please help. Okay, so yeah, this is interesting. I have all these things as well. The one that I use is the one that I first committed to. And that's Yojimbo. But, you know, there's a part of me that really wants to move to Evernote because it's available easily in the cloud. I can access it. You know, I can add things and read things and modify things from my iPhone or my iPad. And I can't do that with Yojimbo. I can get Yojimbo on my iPad, but that's as far as it goes. I can read what I've put in on my Macs. So in that sense, Yojimbo's kind of, holding me back. But it's where I put all my data at first. I really like how simple its workflow is and how it doesn't try to get in my way. In fact, I don't even use the tags that I could use with Yojimbo because, you know, well, two reasons. One, I haven't had a need. And number two, they weren't there when I started using it. So when they finally came around, I would have had to go back and re-tag, you know, years worth of data that sits out there. So, my advice for getting into one of these is, yes, dump everything in and commit, because once you start using it, you'll find the features that you want to use and ignore the rest. You know, don't feel like you have to use every nook and cranny of the software. Just go ahead and use it and, you know, dump everything in. And if once you find you want to categorize things, categorize. If you want to tag instead, tag. You know, and go from there. For me, most of the time in Yojimbo, I'm looking at my entire library and just using the search functionality. I'm usually searching titles of the items in there because that's what works for me. I know what they're named. In fact, I have some things where I have ridiculous names. You know, I have my credit cards in there in a secure note, so it's all encrypted and all that stuff. But I named it something ridiculous so that I put something ridiculous right in the name of, you know, the item so that I could easily search for it. And I would never find anything else in there with that same name in the beginning. And it really, really works. So, but, you know, I can't imagine Bare Bones would come out and tell you, do this with your credit card, you know, name it Rumpelstiltskin so that you can always find it. Right. I mean, that's not what they're going to say, but that's what works for me. I'm just using the framework of the application to store my stuff in there. And I think that's what you got to do is you just got to dump in and commit whatever method you're using previously. For me, it was just a folder of text files. I've talked about it before. Just, you know, dump them all in and whatever, however you've got it and just go. And I think you will like it, but check them out and test, you know, which one's going to work for you. You might find that DevonThink has something, you know, just use the little sample stuff that's in there and see, oh yeah, I could see myself using this, but yeah, Evernote kind of seems to me to be the one, but you know, it's that freemium model. So you wind up putting more data in than you get for free. And you're going to be paying for it for long-term as opposed to just the one shot deal with something like Yojimbo or DevonThink, but maybe that, you know, maybe that's worthwhile to you. So that's my thought on Cruft organizers. I don't think you use one, John, right?
My life's a mess.
But you're having a good time, right?
Well, you know, I got to say about Cruft organizers, I have a very simple system. So a lot of things I organize in mail.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you, my system is simple. So a lot of things I organize in mail. So I have a pretty detailed folder structure within mail.app.
Okay.
To organize things, whether they be Mac Observer or professional or personal. So that's one thing. And the search capability in mail is pretty good. The other is that in my documents folder, I also, so my system is very old school, if you consider the desktop paradigm old school, in that it's basically folders that in my mind, I categorize into things that make sense and then put my contents in there. So I would say between those two and the search capabilities of either mail.app or Spotlight, help me find what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
So I haven't yet, again, I move slow, Dave, you know this. I have not yet dove into or made a decision. I've looked at them on occasion, looked at any one application to help me organize all these things. And I use, actually, the other thing I use is kind of a cheat thing is Sticky's app.
You're not alone. A lot of people do.
Yeah, no, and I have one sticky that has, you know, my, you know, bill reminders, and oh, I know I could do it another way, and another then. So every now and then, if I have an important event in my life, like, you know, planning Macworld, I'll have a sticky for planning my Macworld trip, and I'll, you know, have different flights, and then I'll have the hotel info and, you know things like that.
That's not at all that different from what I use Yojimbo for.
Great.
You know, I create, you know, like for Cirque du Mac, right? I mean, I could build a big Gantt schedule thing to organize all of it, but you know what? I store it all in one text note in Yojimbo.
Sure.
And that works for me. Some people might be hearing this and saying, but Dave, you could, I know I could, but this works. So why, you know, and it's not cumbersome. It's all right there. And it's good, you know, works. So yeah,
Also searchable. Stickies are searchable.
Yeah. And you,
maybe not as sophisticated, you know, but, and you know, sometimes I'll have a different color. So, you know, if this one's, you know, a certain, you know, classification, I'll color it that way. And oh, do I hear the band?
You do.
Are we already there? Talking. Oh my goodness.
The band is coming in slowly today.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it's kind of chilly out.
Yeah. 9 degrees this morning. And I woke up
for
late.
You.
I was up at like.
Well,
eight.
You're in the Great White North there. Well, no, not really.
Take off.
Well, relative to me. Beer hunter, eh?
Yeah.
Yes, for those of you who don't recognize that, Bob and Doug McKenzie, I guess, from Second City Television, was it?
That's right. Yeah, well, that's where they started. And then they had their own movie. And yeah, I watched that. Strange Brew. That was a fantastic movie. If you like, you know, ridiculous movies like that, it was fantastic.
Or Canadians, because they're just funny to begin with, right? As we get all our Canadian subscribers.
See, that's a funny comment because it's xenophobic, right? Wait, no. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, Canada. No, I love Canada.
Sure, why not? They're our neighbors to the north.
And they're very well behaved, unlike the United States, I gotta say, sometimes. We just... all right, enough.
Feedback, no. Premium at MacGeekGab.com is the email address to use to send us comments, questions, tips, pictures, audio, whatever you like.
Dave, I'm going to correct you because I do believe it's premium at MacGeekGab.com.
I said premium at MacGeekGab.com, and by golly, I meant it. 206-666-GEEK is the number, and geek is...
4-3-3-5. But also, Skype... which for us now, I don't know, some people are shaking their fist over Skype 5, but seems to be working okay for us, Dave.
I'm one of them. And you know, I have to say, since you and I switched to using Skype 5 for the podcast here, which was only recently, we have not had a single audio hiccup. So it's interesting, but I think Skype 2.8 was part of our issue there. And perhaps, I don't know, things certainly got better when we moved FireWire to USB. No question about it. But some of those little hiccups still existed.
I still think, though, the Skype 5 UI is a big bag of hurt, as others have said. It's like you didn't need to fix it. I was okay with the old UI. Now it's all kind of shiny and rounded.
No, they want to have the same experience, whether you're on Windows, Mac, iPhone, iPad. It's like, if I'm on
the same
iPad,
horrible experience?
Exactly. I told somebody at Skype that this morning, actually, saying, if I'm on my Mac, I want a different experience than I want on Windows, and frankly, a different experience than I expect on my iPad or whatever. I mean, it's a different OS, and Skype doesn't fit any of them now, so it's beautiful. Excellent job. Really well done.
Oh, look, they're being consistent.
Good on
you. There's something to be said for that.
Good and terrible is what it is. All right.
Is that it?
No, it's not it. We want to thank two people.
Well, of course.
Well, two entities. One is a person, Michael Johnston. Thanks, man. You convert this to AAC every week, and we love you for it. Michael does the We Have Communicators podcast every week as well. And I encourage you to go give that a listen. It's a great show about all things kind of iPhone, iPad, etc. And then the other entity is, of course, Cashfly. And there are many great people there, and we would like to thank them for all the bandwidth. So thanks a lot, folks. And we will be back next week with the next round of Ye Old Geek Gab.
We're
coming up on 6 years.
Of what? Oh.
Of doing this.
Wow.
I know.
If I'd known, I would have baked us a cake.
Yeah, but, you know.